everyone to this very exciting session. I have great promise from all of the speakers here tonight that we're going to take you on an emotional roller coaster. The theme of tonight is why another world is necessary, and then we're going to conclude with why another world is possible. And so we have three speakers here tonight, Liam Ward, Moira Nolan, and Jerome Small. I'll introduce them one by one. But before then, I just want to congratulate everyone on a really wonderful Marxism 2019.
Yeah.
We've had over 1,000 people attend the whole of the conference. Of engagement, participation, debates, arguments, a whole range of kind of people managing to kind of ask questions, intervene. The whole conference is a huge collective effort, which is put on from everyone who brings in a bin or checks a ticket on a door or who cleans a barbecue or who contributes to the sessions. It's really a huge effort on the part of everyone here, so I want to congratulate everyone for their participation. So thank you all for being here. So we're going to start off tonight with the bad news, which is going to be brought to us by Liam Ward. That bad news is basically why another world is absolutely necessary. And so he said to me that he's going to hopes to bring you to angry tears before lifting you up. So we're going to have some of that discussion. I've flown his cover or his methodology. But so Liam Ward is a long-term socialist alternative member. He's a radical filmmaker. He also assures me that if you didn't manage to see his absolutely wonderful film that he spent 10 years making, on the radical Chinese working class struggles in Melbourne, that he can get you a copy post haste. He's also been a long-term refugee activist. He's been involved here in Melbourne since the Tampa incident in the early 2000s when the federal Howard government attempted to vilify and accuse refugees of throwing their children overboard in a disgusting racist display. Liam has since then been on the forefront of every single campaign to free some of the poorest, most oppressed people in Australian society from some of the worst situations. And so he is a wonderful, brave activist, so please make him very welcome.
Well, the theme of this conference, or one of the themes, has been about tearing down walls. And I think in terms of why another world is necessary, I thought I'd start with, I guess, one of the most, maybe the most notorious wall on earth today, which is the Israeli apartheid wall. And I particularly want to look, or I guess start my story in 2003, which is the year that construction on that wall commenced. 16 years later, this thing, this blight on humanity snakes its way through the West Bank, splits people's communities in two, sometimes three, destroys people's villages, blocks people's movements, and is in every way a blight on the earth. And of course, the wall didn't build itself. Human beings had to do that. Real living, breathing workers had to do it. And we can talk about why in another session and who they were. The point is here that the companies that got the contracts to make that wall made massive profits out of it. And I'll get to that in a second. But back in that same year, in 2003, as construction was just beginning, something else was also attracting the attention of millionaires around the world with money to burn. In that year, they started buying tickets for a 90-minute trip on Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic space flights. Now, the lucky early birds at that time got a ticket for $200,000. And if you're keen, I'm sorry to say the price has gone up, $250,000 now. One of the ticket holders, is a dot-com tech millionaire from New Zealand who changed his name by deed poll to Mark Rocket. That's why another world is necessary. I'm going to sit down. Another ticket holder is a guy called Gisli Gislason, who is an electric vehicle entrepreneur from Iceland. He now has Virgin Galactic tattooed on his arm. Now, in the 15 years or 16 years since sales opened, some 600 of these rich dickheads from 58 countries have bought tickets. That's a total revenue from ticket sales alone of between 120 million and 150 million US. The problem is, the spaceships don't actually exist yet. Not a single one of these idiots has actually set foot in space. And by the company's own admission, not a single cent of the money from the ticket sales even goes towards building or designing the spaceships. They quite openly say, no, we're just putting this in our own pockets. They openly say that the money that does go into supposedly developing the spaceships actually comes from different sources. It comes from two in particular, from Branson's broader Virgin Group and from the Mubadala Investment Group, which is owned by the government of Abu Dhabi. Now, Virgin, as you'll know, is a monstrous company in a million ways. All of its arms, from the media to the record label to the airline, even to the gym, are notoriously anti-union. But most disgracefully, Virgin has profited massively from the slow privatisation of Britain's National Health Service. Now, this was a service built over generations with massive funds drawn from the public, from public investment. In the last 5 years alone, Virgin has won 400 contracts worth almost $2 billion from that privatisation job. So really, the point here is that between the state investment from Abu Dhabi and the money that Virgin gets by siphoning off the privatisation of the public health system in Britain, you could actually say that it's the public who are financing the development of these ridiculous spaceships. And meanwhile, to keep the ticket buyers happy, over the years and even the decades, Virgin Galactic does give them a few things. They've taken them on junkets to Branson's private island in the Caribbean. They take them on shooting safaris in Africa. And they give them space-themed cufflinks. Now, Branson himself, always a sleazebag, well-known sleazebag, he promises that the wait will be worth it. He says, that long, drawn-out foreplay can be pretty good. The orgasm is quite quick. Now, Virgin Galactic are in competition with other companies for this lucrative spaceflight market, most notably SpaceX. Now, they all promote it as a project to bring together humanity, a sort of anti-racist thing, as if they're all sort of promoting some kind of John Lennon-esque vision of peace and an end to war and hatred. In fact, theirs is a cutthroat rivalry, and the race to be first has predictably led each company to cut corners, and this has resulted in at least one death of a Virgin Galactic co-pilot, Michael Ellsbury, in a 2014 test flight over California. In a news conference following the crash, Virgin Galactic CEO George T. Whiteside said, "Space is hard, and today was a tough day. I'm sure Ellsbury's loved ones... took some comfort in the darkness after the loss of Michael." Nice. Now, making money out of gullible millionaires and treating pilots as if they're just single-use plastics to throw away isn't George C. Whiteside's only hobby. He also sits on the board of the World Economic Forum's Global Agenda Council on Space Security. And this council describes space, not in the way that you or I might describe space, they describe space as a factor for growth and competitiveness. And they put a value on it, because they have a value for everything. How much is space worth for investors? Well, according to them, it's worth $290 billion. Now, while a Virgin Galactic pilot was innocently living out his last days, unaware that he was about to be killed, the CEO of the company that was about to kill him was engaged in plotting and scheming with the world's richest and most powerful figures in a World Economic Forum meeting in Davos, hidden away in a mountain ski resort with lines of cops keeping protesters at bay. Now, only the richest few can afford to live in the sort of mansion that we assume George T. Whiteside lives in. For the rest of us, housing is something that we'll spend our entire lives panicking about. So I want to talk a bit about that. And it's fair to say most people in this room don't truly know if the day will come when they can no longer pay the rent or the mortgage. In Victoria, the housing crisis has many faces. And in January this year, a productivity report revealed that throughout 2018, Victoria's homelessness services turned away 40% of the people who came to them seeking assistance. They literally did not know what to do with the people that were coming and looking for help. And these people included Tom and Kathy Watts from Sunbury, who spoke to the media about their situation. They had been living in a rented house with damp carpet and cracks in the wall. And this was bad enough. But then Tom lost his job as a bus driver. And this happened at exactly the same time that the landlord kicked them out so they could renovate and put wealthier tenants in. The couple spent 18 months homeless, and no service was able to assist them. Kathy says they didn't even bother applying to public housing because they knew that the waiting lists are over a decade long. And what's the Labor government doing in the face of this public housing crisis? Well, those of you who live here probably know they're continuing to privatise the remaining stock of public housing. They're kicking out residents, they're demolishing the buildings, they're replacing them with glitzy, privately owned buildings that aren't fit for purpose, that are too small for the families they kicked out, and that have private landlords. They call this social housing because even they know, even they don't have the hide to look us in the face and dare to call this thing public housing. And the reality of all this is that capitalism treats housing not as a basic human right, but as a commodity to be bought and sold. Houses are made to be sold, not to be lived in. And if you don't have the money, you don't get one. It's simple as that. In fact, it's worse. When the subprime mortgage crisis tore through the United States a decade ago, there were three immediate consequences. First, there were, well, I guess three factors of the crisis. First, there were a record number of people kicked out of their homes when the banks seized them because they couldn't afford their repayments. Second, because of that, there was a record number of homeless people at levels unseen since the 1930s depression. And third, again, because of the first two, the banks found they couldn't sell the houses they'd just seized because there was a glut on the market. So right when you had record levels of homelessness and record levels of empty homes, and you think, I've got a cunning plan, I know how to fix this. Well, right when that happened, governments and councils across the US started deliberately smashing those houses. They did it to drive down supply and equalise the market. The Wall Street Journal called this the Wrecking Ball Rescue Plan. As I said, the houses were built to be sold, not to be lived in. If you can't sell it, it gets smashed. Now, I mentioned earlier that Virgin Galactic's, I'm going back to the spaceships for a second here, I mentioned Virgin Galactic's main rival is SpaceX. Now, SpaceX is owned by billionaire Elon Musk. Last September, Musk's 70-year-old mother, May, reflected on her life. And she identified her two heroes: the International Monetary Fund's managing director and notorious hater of refugees, Christine Lagarde, and the German chancellor and architect of Greece's brutal austerity package, Angela Merkel. I'm glad you hissed, but for those who don't know what the hisses mean, let's look at Greece. You remember, in Greece, the bankers were bailed out, and the Greek population was punished. Under Merkel's austerity plan, Greece's death rates rose sharply since 2010. Now, some of us are no doubt familiar or remember the incidents of elderly people taking their own lives so as not to be a burden on their children in a country where pensions had practically been abolished. For those of you who don't remember, here's a reminder. In 2012, at the age of 77, retired chemist Dimitris Christoulis walked into Syntyme Square in central Athens and took his own life. In his suicide note, he explained, "The government has annihilated all traces for my survival, which was based on a very dignified pension that I alone had paid for over 35 years with no help from the state." It's his super, basically. He said, "I see no other solution to this than a dignified end to my own life. And I need to do this so I don't find myself fishing through garbage cans for sustenance. And just last year, I mean, the situation hasn't got better. Just last year, The Lancet published a report explaining the other ways in which austerity is killing Greeks. And they identified three main ways. They said newborn babies in Greece are dying of completely treatable conditions, that adolescents and young adults are killing themselves because there is simply no jobs and no future, and third, adolescents and young adults are dying of diseases that are essentially diseases of poverty, smoking, poor diet, alcohol abuse, etc. So this is Mae Musk's hero. Now, Mae Musk herself is a white South African. She and Musk's father, Errol, were part of apartheid South Africa's white ruling class. The father used to drive young Elon Musk to school every day, not in an electric car, but in a Rolls Royce, from their mansion in Cape Town. This is a family whose wealth was squeezed from the blood of black workers. When Musk's parents separated in the late 1980s, he and his mother lived for a few years in Toronto, Canada, where they lived in a government rent-controlled apartment. Now, let's look at that. In November last year, the province of Ontario, of which Toronto is the capital, scrapped those rent controls. Predictably, the house of pricing there has skyrocketed. The city, which was already seeing a massive growth in homelessness over the last 6 months, has reached crisis proportions. Now, of course, where we see a homelessness crisis as a disaster, as, you know, a bad thing, capitalists around the world see this as an avenue for profit, and not in the ways that you might even expect. So 3 weeks ago, Toronto police moved in by force to sweep away hundreds of homeless people from under a bridge of the Gardiner Expressway. A few days later, stunning, beautiful little photographs began appearing. You might have seen them on social media, on the internet, in the newspapers. Beautiful little domes in the snow with orange lanterns and green indoor plants inside. This is Toronto's new luxury dining experience. For just $550, you and your friends, three of them, could be ushered into one of these domes under the expressway and be served up fine food prepared just for you by one of Canada's most prestigious chefs. The first night it opened, where just days before homeless people had huddled together against the cold Toronto wind, now rich, wealthy fucks feasted, guarded by a line of riot cops and a wall while people protested outside. Now that right there, that grotesque vision still doesn't even get close to capturing the full horror of 21st century capitalism. As we know, we are hurtling towards an unspeakable environmental crisis. I don't even have time to go into it, but we know the details. You know, it's best summed up by the amazing 16-year-old activist Greta Thunberg, who said, "I want you to act as if your house is on fire, because it is." We've also seen, over the last 15, 16 years, since the apartheid wall, we've also seen, of course, a growth in far-right movements around the world, fascists taking office in various countries and marching through the streets of various cities around the world. And this has gone hand in hand with a surge in those militarized border walls. When people tore down the Berlin Wall in 1989, there were only 15 of these types of border walls on Earth. Today, there are 70. There are 10 more under construction. There will soon be 80. A recent report on a prominent business website explained with some glee, it's hard to even say these words because they're unbelievable. "We are living in a golden age for militarized border construction companies. They estimate the current global market for militarized border walls at some $53 billion. And no surprise, the companies that built the Israeli apartheid wall, two of them in particular, are also involved in building Trump's wall. So Magal Security Systems and Elbit Systems are both up to their neck in that. I mean, look at the sickness of this. Most people on this planet can't afford housing. Bus drivers can't afford a house. These fuckers are spending money on militarized border walls and non-existent fucking spaceships. I mean, maybe these monsters will spend all their money on a single doomed space flight and we'll be done with it. But we know, I mean, there's only 26 of them, remember? 26 people have the same wealth as the bottom 3 billion. I don't know how big a spaceship is, but 26 seems doable. We know, though, we know, despite, you know, we can dream, but we know that there's always another monster waiting in the wings. We've learnt this over the years and over the generations. We've learnt this through bitter experience. There's always another one. That's why tearing down their walls with all of our collective might will only be the first step in tearing down their entire disgusting, dehumanizing system. It'll be the first little step that we can take in our history towards a whole new way of living together. And look, you know, perhaps that future will involve spaceships. I don't know. Who cares? I can tell you what it won't involve. It won't involve people building and shooting each other at racist, militarized border walls and throwing each other into disgusting racist concentration camps. Now, getting there is going to take serious struggle, serious politics, serious resistance, serious organization, and we need you to join us in that project. It is all hands on deck, and that's why Another World is necessary, and I'm going to have to pass over to someone else to explain the rest of it. But yes, yeah, thank you.
Moira Nolan. She has been a big fan club, I can see. She is fairly newly arrived in Australia. She grew up in Britain. She became politicised during her youthful days. ages up here, but during the miners' strike in Britain, when she saw many of the images of striking miners taking their own working lives into their own hands, attempting to challenge the might and power of the Thatcher government as she was trying to smash up unions right across the country. And Moira said that as soon as she managed to escape the confines of her childhood home and got to the freedom of university life, hopefully like many of you here, she made a commitment to actually joining a revolutionary organisation and has stayed steadfast in that project ever since. So today, she's going to be talking about why Another World is actually possible and not just a pipe dream.
Thank you, Vashti. One of my favourite YouTube clips is of Akala, a black British activist and intellectual. He's actually coming to Australia in May, discussing how change comes about in society. And in this clip, he's speaking at the Oxford Union, one of the great centres of the power of the bourgeoisie intellectually. And he describes a visit to the National Portrait Gallery in London as a seven-year-old on a school trip. And his teacher deliberately stands in front of the picture of William Wilberforce, the British politician who's widely acclaimed as the architect of the end of slavery. And she says to him, "You should be so proud. He ended slavery and freed your people." If you don't know, Akala's family were partly from Jamaica. And seven-year-old Kingsley, which was his name at the time then, looked her squarely in the eye and he replied, "What, miss? By himself?" "You mean he helped." And of course, the reality is that slavery was ended by the real engine of change in capitalist society. Mass sustained struggle, led not by one man, but many, many leaders who learned how to lead in the process of their struggles. Slavery was primarily ended by the slaves themselves making it impossible for the butchers who ruled the empires to carry on doing so in the old way. The thousands who regularly revolted in Jamaica, across the Caribbean and the Americas, across many generations. In the case of British slavery, the key force was of course the unity formed by the slaves and the free people in Haiti in the Haitian Revolution. From 1794, They fought for 10 years to defeat the might of the French, the Spanish, then the British empires in the only successful slave revolt in human history. And just as revolutions today are inspired by events elsewhere in the world, their revolution was inspired by the French Revolution and went on to inspire a mass anti-slavery movement in Britain, of which William Wilberforce, of course, was only the very small tip of a very, very large iceberg. All change has come from below. And we in Socialist Alternative are absolutely proud to stand in the traditions of those across the world that have made those change. Be it the slaves in Haiti in 1794, be it Aboriginal people fighting for their land, be it the workers and soldiers who brought the end of World War I by their revolt, or the black trans activists who led the fight for LGBT liberation in the Stonewall Bar in New York 50 years ago this June. And whenever I think God does our side of the potential to transform the world, I'm always reminded of Marx's famous quote about how class relations are not fixed and eternal, that the world we live in today is just a snapshot, not the whole film of human history. And Marx expressed it by saying, all that is solid melts into air. And in front of our eyes in the last few weeks, we've seen this come to reality for a Sudanese dictatorship of 30 years. For an Algerian... for an Algerian dictatorship that many of my friends in London that I knew in the early 90s who had fled the regime never thought it was possible that that dictatorship would come under the pressure as it has now. And it's just as true for them as it was for the builders of the Berlin Wall, the fascist dictators of Spain and Portugal in the 1970s, and so many examples we've admired, discussed and learned from in this conference. Revolutions are beautiful things. And I'm not ashamed to steal these words from a wonderful Sydney comrade. He wrote this on Facebook last week. And I thought, I'm having that. And he said that bourgeois common sense tells us that revolutions are violent, senseless affairs. It's the total opposite. Revolutions bring out the best in people. Solidarity becomes a living principle and self-management becomes a reality. In stark contrast to the dry formalism of reformist conceptions of transformation as an act of the state, it's precisely from this sort of organic revolutionising of social life from the bottom up that socialism is really built. Always, always in revolutions, the most oppressed rise to be their leaders. Be it Jews in the Russian Revolution, in an empire absolutely built on anti-Semitism for hundreds of years and witch hunt of Jews, or the wonderful women of Sudan today, as Simone told us, whose 70% of protesters are estimated to be women taking part in that revolution. Always, always, the potent strength and talents of working people are brought to the fore when our side fights, and people rise like lions. Revolution dismantles the lies that our rulers rule because we cannot do it ourselves. All across the world, whenever people fight, we see that same self-organisation, the same ingenuity of problem-solving, the same determination to involve all sections of the oppressed on our side. From those wonderful images of children in Sudan, and as a teacher, seeing what happens to young people in our society who are demonised for daring to stand up over climate change, who are demonised and criminalised in Australia and Britain and elsewhere from the age of 10, who are treated appallingly when they dare to congregate in parks. Seeing how in that rising in Sudan, young children and young people taking the leadership of the movement is absolutely brilliant. And a great quote from Ronald Fraser that I nicked from somebody else in this room, who is a lifelong socialist historian who got to witness the struggles of the general strike of 10 million workers in May 68, for me, really captures that feeling that happens to people in revolutions. He said, "The unthinkable had happened. The strikes were like a flame, like everything we had been saying at Nanterre. Fuck hierarchy, authority, this society with its cold, rational, elitist logic. Fuck all the petty bosses and mandarins at the top. Fuck this immutable society that refuses to consider the misery, poverty, inequality and injustice it creates, that divides people according to their origins and their skills. I had never dreamt such a thing could happen." Suddenly, they realised that they had to find a new sort of solidarity. That was what was important about May. Not the slogans like imagination is seizing power and the rest. Not the poetry and exuberance, but this newfound solidarity. That was what May meant to me. I also use that quote because fuck sounds great in a Mancunian accent. And that same spirit of solidarity is witnessed every time our side fights. We discover that competition and greed and self-interest are not innate. They're not natural. They break down every single time our side shakes the chains of capitalism to earth like dew. And the truth is, this happens even in limited periods of struggle. That shows us the possibilities. For the 6 weeks before it was crushed, there was this amazing movement in Beijing, in Tiananmen Square, 30 years ago, starting on May the 4th. And I was a student at the time, and after the massacre took place on June the 4th, this woman that was at my university came back to Leeds from Beijing. And in a meeting, she told this amazing story about the 6 weeks before the protests were crushed, where there was 100,000 people came together, starting with students, then involving workers, in Beijing to campaign against the dictatorship of the regime. And she said that before those protests started, she was on an exchange in Beijing as part of a course. She had plans, she booked a plane ticket to come back to Leeds because she absolutely hated her time in Beijing. She found that what was going on, she felt very isolated, she suffered massive sexism at the university and just didn't think it had worked out. She said those 6 weeks absolutely changed the relationship with the people that she'd been at university with time in, time out. That's a very limited period of struggle. Imagine what it's like in the process of revolution. You see, we need big upheavals, we need revolutions to shift the old order, because as Liam says, these bastards won't give up without a fight. But it's also about making our side fit for the new world that we need to create. The thing I hate most about capitalism is actually the way it works so hard to make us feel small, to destroy our wonderful creativity that we see in every little child who does loads and loads of things. That gets destroyed by us, by the system. It seeks to persuade us that we are not fit to rule. Revolutions are beautiful, but they're also absolutely necessary to make us fit to change the world. They're about creativity on our side. The brutality always comes from their side. And every day when we see the obscenities of capitalism that Liam talked about, we see what they're about. That they would rather let our planet burn a million staff to death every day than be deprived of their power. So they're beautiful and they're necessary in terms of the ruling class, but they're also necessary to help us rid of what Marx said is the muck of ages. And I'm going to finish on this. I've met this fantastic woman comrade from Canberra over the last few days. And when she was talking to me about different things, she talked about the pervasiveness of sexism and how it invades all the decisions and choices we make about who we are in our lives. And she said this really poignant thing. She said, sometimes I don't know whether what I'm doing and what I'm feeling is real. And I think it's an absolute indictment of the way that capitalism alienates us from our very being. Our very beings, our very essence of what we are as human beings in terms of our life. I've left my last sheet there.
Oh.
Sorry. And we need a revolution to sweep away the old order, but also to replace that entire system that invades our very humanity. And it's when we make revolution, when we make fundamental systemic change, it's then and only then can we have a world where we really know about what our choices are, our directions, and that our very beings are real.
Okay, so our final speaker for tonight is going to be Jerome Small. Jerome Small also has a large fan base, so I appreciate Jeremy is the industrial organizer for Socialist Alternative. He talks endlessly, a lot. That wasn't meant to be a full stop, that was just meant to be a comma. He talks endlessly to numerous socialists and non-socialist militants in unions across the whole of the country about the kind of work they're doing, how we can possibly build union strength and working class strength and power in the situation which we're faced today with all-time low industrial militancy. He is one of the most patient people that you will ever meet in your entire life, and he is absolutely committed to trying to build up working class strength and confidence where we can to take it bit by bit and step by step. Jerem is also involved in a very significant project that Socialist Alternative, the host of Marxism 2019, is engaged in Victoria at the moment. That project is the Victorian Socialists. Victorian Socialists did extremely well in the state election that just concluded in November or so of last year. We have decided to set ourselves the ambitious project of engaging again in the federal election. This is an ambitious project, but it is an absolutely necessary one. It is necessary to attempt to repopularise some of the ideas of socialism and to build up more layers of people across this state where we have some of the capacity to do that, who can be confident and to feel like socialism is an alternative, at least electorally, at this stage where we're at, to all of the shit that gets presented to us. So Jeremy's going to be talking a bit about that project right now. Please make him feel very welcome.
Well, we know the stakes couldn't be any higher after we enjoyed yet another record 30-degree day, after the last 30-degree day, after the warmest start and the driest start to a year that Melbourne has ever had. As we look around the world at the teetering tower of debt, like, you know, the economists don't actually know what happens next because the pile of debt has never been higher. As we look around the world and see the rising imperialist tensions between China, the rising empire, and the United States, the existing one. As we look around the world and see the rise of the far right, we know that the stakes couldn't be any higher. We can also see, of course, a glimmer of hope. In fact, more than a glimmer, much more than a glimmer. If we look at Sudan, if we look at Algeria, if we look, according to Simone, Morocco, you know, colossal strikes breaking out in the last couple of days in Morocco. My job is to convince you that in this particular political juncture, in this particular political situation, dominated by the Trumps of the world, dominated by the shit and the horror of the system, that you should devote every nerve that you can over the next 4 weeks to a particular project here in the northern suburbs of Melbourne. And of course, I'm talking about Victorian Socialists. And there's a few reasons why. Reason number one is that you'll find the whole world in the northern suburbs of Melbourne. There's the people which I'll get onto. There's also, you know, manifestations of every single one of the problems that I mentioned, and to go through a few, you know, the climate change. You look at a heat map of Melbourne. Of course, the Bayside suburbs, the eastern suburbs, heaps of trees, a nice Bayside breeze and all the rest of it. Where the bulk of the working class lives out north and out west, they don't get any of that. So the effects of climate change, you know, climate change is a class issue, as we always say. And you can see that on a hot day, pretty much any day nowadays, out in the northern suburbs. We can see the obscenity of borders. You know, borders, as we heard in one of the speeches this week, one of the interventions, in fact, in a session just this weekend. The way that the border force conceive of a border is not just some static external line. The border is a continuum, they say. And you can find that border running through Broadmeadows. You can find that border in the Broadmeadows Detention Centre, our own little obscene hellhole where people have been kept for years. No charge, no trial, just you're not allowed into this country and we're going to keep you locked up potentially forever. If you want to talk about the question of wage theft, well, you know, we've got the biggest workplace in the whole of Melbourne, Melbourne Airport out there, and you can knock on some doors. You'll find, as I did, a garbage truck driver used to get $43 an hour, nice 8-hour day, now he's getting $26 an hour flat rate. He leaves home at 2 in the morning, gets home at 5 in the evening, and he makes barely any more money than what he earned before. And of course, if you've been in Melbourne, or if you've been paying attention around Australia, if you wanted to put on a postcard the problems that are confronting the working class today, well, you probably couldn't do much better than the catastrophic fire and toxic plume of smoke that engulfed the northern suburbs just 2 weeks ago. And I hope the people have read the report in Red Flag, the only media outlet that I know of that's bothered to seek out the workers at the centre of this fire and talk to them and find their account not only of the work they did of handling toxic chemicals, being compelled to handle toxic chemicals and dead laboratory animals and used hospital samples and every other toxic thing that ends up there without any protective equipment, not only being paid $2 or $4 below the award, not only being exploited because, you know, the boss looked at them and they were small and brown and refugees from Sri Lanka and survived the Civil War, so he thought, okay, this is an easy mark, I can exploit them. Not only that, but you can read their account of how they unionised, how they defied that expectation of the boss, how they all joined the union, and how they were desperately trying at the time of that explosion to clean up the health and safety in that hellhole, not only to protect themselves, but to protect every single person in the northern suburbs. Which brings me to the other thing that you find in the northern suburbs of Melbourne, of course, which is not just the problems of the world, but the solution to those problems, that being the working class. And people have talked plenty, and I hope people heard on Thursday night, Hussein Al-Qatari. Like, you could stand around on that picket line. I just will never get sick of it, you know? Like, you're in suburban Melbourne, and people are just sort of, you know, standing around, as you do. And they're bringing a multi-billion dollar corporation to a grinding halt. And they are from the Four Corners. From the four corners of the world, and they are every single faith in the world, and, you know, and they are the solution. They found the solution to casualisation, to low wages, to the gross sexual harassment, you know, the systematic, you know, yeah, basically, you don't give me sex, you don't get any shifts. That's the line from management at Chemist Warehouse. Let's not beat around the bush. And to push management back in that circumstance, you know, is an incredible and inspiring thing. You'll find that in the northern suburbs of Melbourne. But we also have a problem, which is you knock on the doors of the northern suburbs of Melbourne, around Caldwell anyway, and you find a lot of things. You find fear. You know, the day after that fire, door knocking in Coolaroo and talking to a woman whose kid was sent home from school, but they were sent home to Coolaroo, directly south of the fire, actually closer than where the school was. Like, where the hell are they meant to go? You find a man and a woman with the woman's got a persistent cough, and she says, oh yeah, since the fire it hasn't been much good. And they start comparing notes, oh, well, at least it's not as bad as the last one. And the woman says, no, you mean the top one before, you know? Like, and like, this happens so often that people have lost track out there. There was another report today of a plume from God knows where just drifting over Coolaroo, of toxic smoke and all the rest of it. And you'll find a deep bitterness at what this society does to the people that create all of the wealth of this society. You'll also find a hard-bitten and fully justified cynicism about politics, a cynicism that comes from decades of one-party rule in the northern suburbs by a party called the Australian Labor Party. It's not easy to cut through that. I guarantee if you knock on a door out past the Ring Road and you say, hi, Victorian Socialists, we're a new political party, we're running in the elections, 80% of people at that point will say, see ya, and close the door. The only way you can cut through is to say, hi, Victorian Socialists, we think the big corporations are out of control, they've got the main parties in their back pocket, we want to give them a God almighty kick come election day. And with that, at least you sort of stop them while they're about to close the door. And then you've got a chance to have a discussion, and it can go all sorts of directions. It's a great experience, like just, you know, giving it a go, stuffing it up, and you've got another door, do it a little better. And of course, you know, yeah. One of the things that you'll find out there, and a product of the deep cynicism and the feeling of powerlessness, you know, that comes from one-party Labor Party rule out past the Ring Road, of course, is racism. And that's a really, you know, like a lot of the best discussions that I've had, you know, with a South Asian woman, you know, cataloguing the problems, you know, her husband, 73, suffered from cancer, can't afford to stop working because she's still, it's just like, it's, you know, and all of a sudden she says, oh, yes, and there's the African gangs. Sometimes you can cut through that and say, oh, look, I think there's a lot of scapegoating. You know, I think the rich and powerful don't want to fix the problems in our lives. They just want to give us people to blame. You know, oh, don't blame me for the lack of health care or decent pensions. I'm just the richest person in the country. It's like, oh, that migrant will do, or, you know, that Muslim will do. And very often you can stop it right there. Sometimes you can almost physically see the penny drop. Because no one, the Labor Party, the unions, the Greens, no one has bothered to make a class argument about racism, to say, this isn't just some moral failing, this is a deliberate strategy of the ruling classes. To the extent that we buy it, we stand divided and distracted and unable to fight. And it is, like, is, you know, heartening evidence of the way that socialist politics can make sense of the world to the working class, how often that can cut through. And, of course, you'll find people just living their life, you know, cleaning up the house, mucking around with the kids, enjoying the sunshine, because, of course, the sun still shines in the northern suburbs. And it's in this environment, in these streets, in that sunshine, with those humans, that we want to conduct a very significant political experiment over the next 4 weeks. And we want to demonstrate through that the political effect that we have. We want to be able to demonstrate in practice that it's possible to build an alternative to the Labor Party. That it's possible to build an alternative to a party that, you know, like even when it was founded in the 1890s, Henry Lawson's line was, oh, our best are leaving the country and our worst are going into Parliament. You know, the Labor Party's never been any good, but it's plumbed new, it's always been the party of racism and war. It seems to have plumbed new depths in terms of distance from the working class and total disconnection from its base. We demonstrated on a small scale in the state election that it was possible to build an alternative to that based on principled socialist politics and practical policies that flow through from that in the here and now. We want to be able to demonstrate that again. We want to be able to demonstrate in practice that we can build an alternative to the Greens. That's not such a big problem out in Colwell, where I'm campaigning. Colleen, you know, we were out door knocking the day after the fire, and hit a door, and, you know, Colleen was saying, look, it wasn't the greatest conversation, you know, the person's not there, so we didn't seem to be getting anywhere. And as she was turning around, he said, oh, by the way, where the hell are the Greens? He'd been looking at their Twitter feed, he'd been looking at their Facebook, like all of their social media. This is like 36 hours after the fire, they had not even bothered to post on Facebook about it. So to be able to demonstrate in practice, like a political alternative that not only posts on Facebook, you know, like three or four times you're up to by then, but by that time, 36 hours after the protest, had talked to our local residents, had basically got one of our supporters, Marcus Harrington, who you heard on Thursday night, to storm the community consultation meeting and hijack it and take it over. So it was the voice of outraged residents. And had also actually initiated and called a demonstration and, you know, got a leaflet out for that already. Like, that, you know, being able to say that's the sort of party that we are, you know, to be able to build a viable vote for that means something. It means something to the people that we meet on the Chemist Warehouse picket line. They say, oh, yeah, the socialists. Yeah, I think I voted for you in the election. Or I looked for you on the ballot paper. I live in Ascot Vale. You know, we weren't there. It means something to the people that we meet, on the campuses. who, you know, like just through our efforts, have all of a sudden, oh, okay, socialism isn't some totally fringe thing. It's something that matters in what's regarded as mainstream political life. It matters for all of those reasons, and it matters to be able to demonstrate to the whole country and, in fact, to the whole world that socialist ideas make sense of working class life and working class struggle like no other set of ideas. That's what we have a chance to do over the next 4 weeks. If we don't have our sights set on the lofty heights of class struggle, if we don't have our sights set on revolution, on overturning this system, on instituting a whole new system based on human need and not on profit, unless you're pointing in that direction, you're going to end up in some pretty strange places. Sooner or later, you're going to end up in some version of, you know, like God Almighty, like Get Up, or, you know, like the phone banking for the Labor Party or something. Like, you know, like you need that. You need to have that orientation. The whole system is rotten and you've got to go. But very often, you then have to look down to exactly where your feet are standing, pointing in that direction, and you have to take a couple of small steps. Sometimes that's in a campaign. Sometimes that's at your work. Sometimes that's doing, you know, the smallest thing imaginable. For the next 4 weeks, for people in Melbourne, for people interstate, I'll be marking the roll. I want to see you on election day. You can always come back. Victorian Socialists is that project. There's a lot of practical work to be done. I know a lot of people here have said, yes, I'll do the work, you know, I'll get around to it. Well, the time to get around to it is this week. Like, if you are, I know a lot of people are exhausted after this, you deserve a day off, that's great. A bunch of us are meeting up 10 a.m. at Broadbeno Station if you want to come and join us. If you're from interstate especially and you want to kill a couple of hours meeting some people in the sunshine of the north of Melbourne, come and find us. For others, like I know the student clubs, you know, people do actually need to pass their exams and all the rest of it, so don't begrudge you that day. But, you know, like I know a lot of effort is going on to make sure that we can put in those hours later in the week in a consistent way and sustainable way over the next few weeks until election day. It's going to be hard slog. Not every door that opens is a decent conversation. You still get some people going, oh, the political class at the door. Oh, my God, what are we doing, you know? And that's totally understandable. But it's worth doing because the stakes could not be higher. Jamie Stone reminded us last night in the performance that fascism is the politics of despair and that socialism is the politics of hope. And this is our opportunity to demonstrate in practice that the politics of socialism can cut through that defeated shrug, that resignation, that hard-bitten and totally justified cynicism that comes from one-party rule north of the Ring Road, that we can cut through that, that we know that the problems of the world come from the profit system, that we know that the solutions of the world come from the working class. All we need, is the politics and the organisation. So let's take some concrete steps towards that over the next 4 weeks. Thank you. Thank you.